This episode is brought to you by Summer School Electronics. With pedals like the Snow Day Delay, the Pep Rally Fuzz, the Trash Panda, and my personal favorite, the Science Fair, which is two classic dirt pedals in one with a mid-boosted overdrive on one side, a black lab rat circuit on the other, and a blend knob to blend between them to find the perfect classic stacked dirt sound you're looking for, it's hard not to find something you'll love. Mark builds all of his pedals by hand in Syracuse, New York, where he also works as a full-time educator. In addition to the super fun graphics on their pedals, Mark also offers custom artwork. Want your dog's face on a pedal? He can do it. Want your face on a pedal? He can make that happen too. Go over to summerschoolelectronics.com and make sure to tell them that 40 Watt Podcast sent you. Morning, afternoon, evening, whatever it might be, wherever you are when you are listening to this. 40 Waters, appreciate you tuning in, checking it out. Whether you are watching or listening, I really appreciate you giving me some of your time today, whatever day that might be. Really excited about the episode today, but as usual, I am going to throw all of this stuff up front. I think I even have a shorter, more condensed version of my self-shill that I like to do to y'all. Please, if you have a chance, go over to 40watt.com or linktree.com/40watt podcast. Sorry, I said 40watt.com. Don't go to that website. That's not me. 40wattpodcast.com or Linktree. Links are down below in the description of the episode or in the description of the video. There you can find all of my links. You will find links to social media. You will find links to Patreon. You will find links to my Reverb affiliate program. You will find links to our semi-new Discord server. You can come hang out with us. You do not need to be a Patreon supporter to hang out in Discord and just talk to us, although Patreon supporters do get a little extra privilege and extra chat room of their own. And go over to Patreon, patreon.com/40wattpodcast, where for as little as $3 a month or as much as you want to give, you can support this podcast. And at the same time, you can help support a really great charity. This year, I'm giving 25% of the proceeds of my Patreon to St. Jude Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. It's a charity that I've raised money for years. I'm a big believer in the work they do. If you don't understand how important St. Jude is, you should go check out how much they alone have reduced mortality rate for children in cancer treatment. It's really unbelievable. I think they are one of the most worthy charities out there in the country. So go check that out. I added some new tiers to the Patreon. So here's what's going to happen this week. I have introduced a $5 tier where for $10 a month, you are going to get all of the stuff for the regular Patreon supporters. You're going to get the extra channel in Discord. You're going to get the stickers, you're going to get extra notice of any new merch or anything going on, but you're also going to get an extra episode every week. I don't know what that's going to be every week. Sometimes it's going to be extra content with whoever my guest is. Sometimes it'll be someone else completely different. It could be I could do rapid fire questions with my guests. I could do an album review with someone else, or who knows what it'll be on a given week, but you will get extra content every week. For your support, and I really appreciate it. And I did add a really crazy high tier. If anybody's really insane, for $50 a month, I will give you a music lesson every month live. Well, I can teach you music theory. We can talk guitar. We can talk bass. I will pretend to teach you keys if you want. I don't really care. If you just want to sit and bullshit for 30 minutes, I will do it. If anyone's insane enough to take that tier, that'd be awesome. I will also send you a t-shirt and you can be on the podcast. I don't care. It'll be awesome. So I think I'm done now. That's my self-shill. I think I got it in under 4 minutes. So that's pretty good. So now we're going to move on to the real reason anyone's probably listening to this. Today's episode, I've got Ryan from Demos in the Dark on the show. Super pumped to have him come talk to me. He was just on just before this episode went out on the Guitar Knobs podcast, and I heard him talk, and I realized I'd never really heard heard, Ryan, never heard your story until I heard you on that podcast. I've been watching your demos for a while. But,
oh, right on.
Yeah, so I know you shared it on Guitar Knobs, so I'm not gonna force you to go through all that again, but give the Reader's Digest version. How'd you get into this?
I work for, first off, also I'm really glad to be here. So thank you for having me. Side note, I used to teach lessons when I was in college to a lot of young kids, and one of them, he was the hardest kid to teach, and because he just, like, he would get in the room, his parents would leave, and then he would just go bonkers. And I started to notice that every time he showed up, he was wearing a different, like, uniform. It's like he showed up, he was wearing, like, soccer. You know, like, the next time he showed up, he was wearing, like, basketball stuff. And I finally pulled his mom aside at one point. I went, like, how much is this kid involved in? Because he was, like, 10. And she listed a litany of things that this kid was involved in. And, you know, so guitar lessons was, like, the least of this kid's concerns.
Yeah.
And so I worked out a deal with him. And I said, if I will give you really small things to learn, really, really small things to learn, if you can learn them and have them ready by the time you come to the next lesson, we can go through that. I'll introduce the next thing. If we can do that in 5 minutes, you can spend the rest of the 25 minutes watching television.
Did it work?
Worked. That's all the kid wanted. That's all the kid wanted. I'm like, 5 minutes is enough to show your parents that you're doing something. Yeah. And if you need 25 minutes to be a kid, take it. Take it here. Just give me that 5.
Absolutely.
So I was thinking about that as you were talking about, you know, I'll pretend to do keys and, yeah, you know, whatever.
it's a great point. You know, I used to teach lessons, like, years and years ago. I taught right after I have a music degree. I got it from a small university in Mississippi. And after college, you know, to make money, I taught lessons. Yep. It actually ended up in a job with me teaching elementary school choir for a year, which is, wow, exactly how long I needed to know I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life at all.
I'm sure you knew before that year was over.
Oh, yeah. Oh, big time. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know this, but teachers only ever really remember the name of all the problem kids. They don't remember the names of the good kids because they don't have to say their names. So, right. Kids, the attention span on a child, and parents would want to sign up for these, like, hour long weekly lessons. And I'm like, there is literally zero chance I am going to, mm-hmm, hold your child's attention for an hour. And that's not a me thing. That's a kid thing. Yeah. And I shortened it to half an hour, and I was still like, I'm going to be lucky to hold on to 15 minutes.
Yeah.
That's the way it's going to go. And I've had to have a few of those conversations with parents, children, where it's like, I had one kid in particular, he would come in. He and his brother, I'd give them both lessons. And at some point, I finally pulled the mom aside and the dad. And I was like, okay, here's the deal. This one, I can't remember their names right now. It's been a while. I remember their last names, but I won't put it out there. He's fine. It's no big deal. Your other one really needs to play drums. Like, guitar is not going to be his instrument. It's just really not. So I think he may have ended up actually taking up drums, but don't quote me on that.
So you just made those parents' life a living hell after that.
Well, I didn't have to give him the lessons.
That was beautiful revenge there.
Oh, yes. Oh, great. I love giving lessons. I started doing it with some folks from the Get Offset Patreon group. Mm-hmm. There's a Discord channel for them. We've missed the last couple of weeks, but we've been doing like a Sunday night music theory, like, circle where they just bring questions and I start to explain music theory concepts as best I can, because I have this idea for a YouTube channel. And I guess I'm going to give it here. And so if somebody wants to steal it, go ahead and steal it, where I was going to do 5 minute music theory. And I basically, mm-hmm, if I couldn't explain a concept in 300 seconds, then it was too big a concept and I needed to break it down. And so, sure, I was going to do really, really basic music theory. It's been fun. It's been a fun group.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported in part by String Joy Strings,
I'm a snob. At least that's what people tell me. I'm never okay with good enough, and that's where Stringjoy strings come in. They're better than good enough. They're the best. Stringjoy are making some of the finest strings available today right up the road from me in Nashville, Tennessee. They offer custom sets, balanced tension, coated strings, the works. If you need it, they can probably make it happen. You should be using Stringjoy strings, and if you're going to order from them, you really could help this podcast out by clicking the affiliate link down in the description or show notes below. You get amazing strings, I get a little bit of that back to help the show keep going. It's a win-win situation. Get your Stringjoy strings today.
That's awesome. I, like you, I went to school for music composition. Right out of school, started touring, and that was great. That was really good. Moved to New York, started doing session work.
Nice.
A lot of ad work. And that, the ad work has actually informed me doing gear demos, because part of what you do when you do ad work, when you're not working on a specific project, whatever firm you're working for will allow you to just basically fill up a vault of ideas, and clients can come in, and if they go, oh, I want something that sounds like this, they can go, they can pull up samples, and you know, if all goes well, they're done. They, you know, they license that to that person and it's over. But it didn't usually work out that way. Usually, you know, people are spending a lot of money. They want something, you know,
oh yeah,
pretty specific. So, and then I moved back to Minneapolis, I got married, had a kid, and stopped touring as much. And a friend of mine was starting a little distribution firm called Mass Distro, and he asked if I wanted to just really help out, you know, a little bit here and there. It was going to be this severely part-time thing. And I said, sure. And, you know, here we are a couple of years later, and we are this international firm. We have an office in Dublin. We, you know, we're looking at an office in Australia, and, you know, it became a real job. But for a while, it was just the two of us. And at one point he goes, you know, maybe we should look at doing some content for our clients, like video content.
Yeah.
And being that it was just the two of us, you know, the two of you do everything, and you know, we kind of drew straws on it, and I drew the straw to do the demoing part of it. And the, you know, the first 50 were terrible, like just horrible. And I, the name Demos in the Dark came from the fact that I had no idea how to use a camera. My partner loaned me a camera, and I was too afraid to touch any of the knobs. And I, you know, it was set with like the aperture super low or high or whatever. I'm not really even sure, but it was an already dark room. And then I made it even darker with the camera. So that turned into, yeah, you know, I just pointed out the most obvious thing about it. You know, I was like, oh, it's what I got, and it's in the dark. So that became Demos in the Dark. But also, you know, I'm a sideman by trade, and I prefer to be in the back of the stage in the dark behind whoever the front person is. So I also kind of view that as being a bit symbolic here with Demos in the Dark too, where I like the idea of taking a backstage to whatever product it is that I'm reviewing. And, you know, I'm just the messenger. The product is the star. And
sure. It's not so, about you. It's about, yeah, people want to hear the gear.
Yep. Absolutely. That's a hard lesson to learn in this, because you do start to think that it's you doing it. And for me, you know, I hadn't fully accepted it. Until I had mostly accepted it. It was something that I knew intrinsically in my head. But I did a video where I rehabbed my dad's 72 Les Paul custom. And, you know, I I brought in Righteous Sound pickups, and I had a luthier friend in town to do the work. I was filming on location. I mean, it was the most work that I had put into a video whatsoever. And it flopped. Like, it flopped big time when it went live. And, you know, the reality kind of hit me. It was like, nobody could buy that 72 Les Paul. Like, that. Yeah, like, yeah. And they didn't really care about this story. Some did. You know, there were some subscribers who were like, man, that was great. But for the most part, you know, like, I'm an advertisement. And that's what it is. And, you know, and I do take a backseat to the product. And it's a weird thing to realize. But it also, once you do realize it, it takes a lot of pressure off, if that makes any sense. You know, like, if something does really, really bomb, you can have been the one that bombed video. I mean, that is entirely possible. It happens all the time. But, you know, in if something just never takes off, you can kind of go, well, it's not a thing that people were interested in seeing. So yeah.
Actually, it went. So you mentioned that on the Guitar Nubs podcast, and it actually made me. It made me feel better because I've started to try to get into demoing and doing some things, and I'm not good with cameras. I'm not good with any of this stuff. And to be honest, like, my music background is I'm an improv guy. You know, it's where I always was. I learned to read. I learned to play parts. I learned to do all that kind of stuff in school. But my natural state is, okay, rough chord structure. Sort of a style. All right, let's go. You know what I mean? And that's how I play my most creatively. It's how I play my most skillfully. But if you just sit me down, that's with other musicians. You sit me down by myself and you want me to play riffs for a pedal, I'm like, I don't know anything. I don't know. And so knowing that it's not me helps.
Yeah. And so the other thing that I learned that, you know, I've only been doing this a few years, and I feel like I've already just learned a ton about the process. But the other thing I learned is that people give noodlers a hard time. The folks who will do gear demos and then they just shred. And I get that. Nobody wants to hear that. And I've taken it a step further. So when I go into the actual... You know, usually it starts with some kind of introduction, and then there's the track portion of it where I show how this can be used in a mix, and then I go into it all by itself. And for that portion of it, I have not only stopped noodling, I've stopped riffing for the most part, and I will just stick to chords, and I will stick to not only just chords, I will stick to chords that everybody knows. So the A's and the C's and the G's and the D's and the E's. And the reason for that is if you're doing that, the most accomplished guitar player watching the video will be able to watch that and relate to it because they know how to play A's and G's and C's and D's. And the beginner level guitar player will also be able to relate to that and imagine themselves playing that because they also know how to play A's and C's and G's and D's. And so that's become a thing that that part is I dumb it down as much as possible and just go really basic and just strum chords. Just do that because that way everybody gets to be in.
Yeah.
And you know, when you get into that really, really shreddy stuff and you get into that, sure, it's impressive, but not everyone can imagine themselves doing that. And therefore, if I'm showing someone a piece of gear that they might be interested in, I want to show them what it might be like if they were using it. So I keep that really, really basic. Sometimes I get complaints. So, you know, sometimes people are like, hey, you should put another riff. And I'm like, you know what? Shut up. Like, you know, I mean, just like, but for the most part, I don't. And for the most part, people thank me. They're like, thank you for playing chords, you know? And so I absolutely, you know, like Ian at Collector Emitter is a very good friend of mine. And he comes up with just incredible stuff. He also has never tuned his guitar to standard tuning in his entire life, I don't think. But he, you know, every single time he comes up with something very, very cool and very unique. And I have all kinds of respect for that. At the same time, it's very accessible. I don't have the capacity to do that. So I try to keep everything as accessible as possible for everybody.
Sure. No, it makes total sense. It's like, I really like the, other demoers besides yourself who I really like, because they similar to that is like someone like Pete Thorne, who's out there. He now, not everybody's going out there and building a whole track of like 4, 5, 6 guitar parts and showing off everything a pedal can do. But, you know, Pete can shred. He can play his ass off. And generally in those demos, he doesn't. I mean, occasionally every now and again, he'll flash a little bit. But for the most part, he's not playing anything I can't play.
Yeah,
when he is 100% capable of playing stuff I cannot play.
And I think, you know, I think to a certain extent, to be satisfying to whoever's doing it, like, you do have to stroke your own ego a little bit. And the way I do that is with the first 2.5 minute track portion of it.
Yeah.
You know, there I take every liberty that I want to, and I do that. And that's a full studio produced piece. And, you know, that's the one thing like that. That's your reel them in with that thing. And then, but when it comes down to the action, and, you know, what's funny is I know I've talked to numerous people who skip the track part and go straight to the raw demo. I know people who just watch the track and skip the raw demo. Most everybody I know skips through my introduction. So, yeah, you know, it's a smart way to cover everybody in one shot. And, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be the first thing in the world where, you know, simpler is better.
Yeah. And sometimes that just is the case. And it makes a lot of sense. And if you're not doing too much, you actually hear what a lot of the gear is doing much more so. Then if you're flashing all kinds of technique and all kinds of crazy things going into it, you don't actually get to hear what's the pedal and what's the player.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's funny is, you know, I, for a while I was doing demos for Premier Guitar, and in the initial conversation, they were like, "We love the fact that you do this because you can hear the pedal," and, you know, and I went, "Okay, cool." And I did a number of videos for them, and then, they stopped calling me, and now they have Vava doing it, and she is, you know, she's not playing chords. She is
not at all.
She's impressive and super impressive and really fun to watch. But I, you know, I was like, you guys changed your mind on that whole concept.
yeah, they did. Yeah, I, you know, and there's a lot of that going around, and it's like, I don't know, for God, I'm going to get so like, get off my lawn here for a second. You know, I'm a blues guy first. I'm a roots guy second, and I'm a jazz guy third. And that jazz, I put in quotes, right? Like no one's ever going to hear me play and accuse me of being a jazz guitar player. They might hear me hit some bad notes and I'll call it jazzy. That'll be what it is. but I like speed and technique and flash just like everybody, but it's like when I listen to, actually, I'm going to tell it this way, and this is going to be a complete like 180 from where I was just going, but I think you'll get it. Buddy of mine and I, like this friend of mine, not many people get to be friends with the person who is their like guitar goal. And my buddy Marshall, I grew up with Marshall. He introduced me to like a ton of my favorite bands. And he is like the player who I think always plays the right note at the right time. He doesn't hit bad notes. Mm-hmm. His phrasing is perfect. And so he and I went to see the Derek Trucks Band in Memphis, Tennessee.
Sure.
And he had never listened to Derek Trucks. I'd been listening to Derek's Trucks for about 5 or 6 years at that point. We went, we watched the concert. It was incredible, just unbelievably good. We left, and on the drive home, we lived in the Mississippi Delta, Clarksdale, driving home. He's like, you know, normally I go and I hear a great guitar player and I either want to quit playing or I want to practice more.
Yep.
He said, I don't feel either one of those things because the way he plays is so foreign to me. He may as well have been playing flute. And yeah. That's what I think about, like the shredders or the like. I love watching players like Yvette Young. I love watching her play. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but her playing doesn't inspire me to play because it is so outside of what I would do.
Yeah.
Or and so that's what I feel about that thing.
Yeah. No. And that's a certain level of enjoyment. All in it, because you don't have to look at it from an academic level. I feel that way about Bill Frisell, where I can't begin to think like Bill Frisell thinks. And because of that, when I go to Bill Frisell concerts or when I'm listening to Bill Frisell records, I can just shut off and not try. Like, I'm not even going to try to think about what it is that he's doing. I'm just going to listen to it and enjoy it. And Trex is absolutely that same way. Trex borrowed my amp once. we were playing a festival. He was flown in, and I think he played three shows that day.
Oh, wow.
So he flew from New York into Wisconsin where that festival was, and then was flying out to California after that. But the amp that he rented didn't arrive or something like that. And so, you know, there were sound guys running around all the other, you know, tents and stuff like that and asking if anybody had a vintage Fender amp. And I happened to have, at that point in time, I was playing an old Blackface Twin. And I guess Trucks was like, yeah, we'll take that. and yeah, super nice dude. Really, I mean, really just unassuming, you know, and really down to earth. Really cool guy. If you would have met him and didn't know what he was capable of, he would give you no indication of what he's capable of. One of those kind of guys.
Yeah. That's everything I've heard about him. That's absolutely.
Yeah. You wouldn't have known that the dude grew up with the freaking Allman Brothers.
Right.
Exactly. I could have had a conversation with him about the Allman Brothers. I'm sure he never would have even mentioned it.
Yeah, would have never mentioned he, you know, replaced, you know, took that role in the Allman Brothers. He'd never say it.
He is a heck of a dude, and he made my amp sound a lot better than I ever did at that point. So,
yeah, no, he actually just played. I didn't get to go this weekend because I really, really, really wanted to. So Saturday night, as we're recording this, which would have been, I don't know, don't make me count backwards, the 5th, June 5th.
Okay.
They dedicated or opened the new wing of the B.B. King Museum in Indianola, Mississippi.
Okay.
And they had a big dedication thing. They had my buddy Christone Kingfish Ingram played it. Derek Trucks, Susan Tedeschi was there. Gary Clark Jr. was there. I mean, they had a ton of players there. And like, there's some really cool photos of him paying respects to B.B. King. And one of the guitar he played for it is one that he owns, but it was one of B.B. King's personal guitars.
Cool.
And so it's real weird to see him not playing an SG, but it is what it is. You know, he's going to play the guitar that was right for the moment. But I haven't met him yet. I'm going to one of these days.
No, and you're going to be a better person for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, he was one of those where I was young. I was like 21 and he was probably 21. And
it's actually his birthday today as we're recording this.
No way. That's cool. And I, you know, I was working on a, you know, post music school ego. Meeting that guy, I remember walking away going like, gotta be more like that guy. Gotta be more like that guy.
Yeah.
Like in all, like in every way, except for the ponytail. Like,
I had the ponytail at one time too. I got pictures
super, super great dude. And, super great player. One of my favorite, videos out there of him is, it's like him, Joe Bonamassa, and why am I drawing a blank on his name? Billy Gibbons.
Oh.
And they're kind of doing the thing where like they're passing the solo back and forth to each other thing. And, you know, Billy's doing Billy And, you know, then it goes to Bonamassa and he just does Eric Johnson. And, you know, really, really fast and like nothing to grab onto, yeah. You know, and then it goes to Trucks, and the Trucks solo ends up going a lot longer than anybody else's because mm-hmm. Trucks is building a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and just the difference in maturity. I'm going to and people are going to hate me for saying this, but the difference in maturity between Derek Trucks and a guy like Joe Bonamassa is insane. Because in my opinion, Trucks is never playing a part. He's never playing a lick. He's never playing a riff. He's never playing a run. He is constantly telling a story.
Yep. He's building a story.
And somebody like Joe Bonamassa has got a bunch of really impressive practiced scales and riffs and licks and things like that. And, you know, economy picking and, you know, whatever. And again, that's impressive. I went to see Dream Theater once. And the reason I went to go see Dream Theater was because the group that was opening up for them was the Dixie Dregs, Steve Morse has
been a guitar hero for years for me.
Yeah. And I wanted to see Steve Morse. So I go to this theater and I watched the Dregs set and it was cool. It was super cool. And I watched song and a half of Dream Theater. And, you know, like in that time I was able to go, it is so cool that you guys can do this. And this is like almost like watching a sporting event. Like you guys are freaks lifting weights, you know, like you guys.
Have you seen Petrucci? He looks, you know, he looks like a football player.
He looks like he's lifted a weight or two. But then after that song and a half, you know, I was kind of like, well, now I got it. Like I got the gist of it and now I'm leaving.
Yeah.
And so I'm walking out and I'm in the lobby of this theater and there's a guy standing there. And I remember he was wearing a Dream Theater t-shirt. I feel like when I tell the story, he's also wearing a Dream Theater hat and a Dream Theater fanny pack with like all of his drum keys in it.
Yeah.
And you know, he stops me on the way out the door and he goes, "You going for a smoke?" And I go, "No, I'm leaving." And he goes, "Why are you leaving?" I'm like, "Well, I came to see the Dregs. And they're done now." And and he goes, "John Petrucci could kick Steve Morse's ass." I'm like, well, Steve Morse is like 60. So, you know, like probably. And he was like, "Whatever, dude." He's like, "You are missing the best band that you've ever heard in your life." And I look back over him and I'm like, "So are you." And he was like, I think every guitar player goes through the thing where like you start to get some chops, mm-hmm. You start to get some knowledge. Once you get the chops and the knowledge down, it's fun to play fast and it's fun to do, you know, almost aerobic activity on your guitar. But, you know, at some age, I just learned that, I don't think people, I mean, there is a select group of people who love to listen to that, but the bulk of the, you know, population can't relate to something like that.
No.
When you think about the guitar players that I really enjoy, you know, you're talking about like the Keith Richards of the world, you know, and he was an impressive player who did one of my favorite guitar solos is the guitar solo at the end of Goodbye Stranger from Supertramp. And most of it is just one note. Yeah. But it fit and it was perfect. I had a professor in college too, who, you know, I think it was actually Eric Johnson. I was really into Eric Johnson. And I remember this professor was like, "Can you whistle me the, you know, the first couple notes of that and drew to the Clissa Dover. And I was like, no. And he's like, whistle me take five. And I was like, no problem.
Yeah, exactly.
And at that point, he was like, that's a song. That's a performance. And I was like, that makes sense. You know, like there is songwriting and there are performance pieces. And yep. Dream Theater, while their stuff is, while they're technically songs, they're written songs, they are, for all intents and purposes, performance pieces.
Yeah.
You know, someone like Kurt Cobain was a songwriter. You know, you can take any of his songs and move them into a completely different genre. You can take any of those songs and just put, you know, you want to do a reggae version of Come As You Are, no problem. It'll sound great.
Yep.
Because he's a songwriter. So those are songs, those are performance pieces. And once you can kind of separate those, you can decide what you're in the mood for or what direction you want to focus your career on. I consider groups like Led Zeppelin to be performance pieces as well, because, you know, it's like a good indicator of that is you've never seen a Led Zeppelin cover band that sounds good. Because it had to be those guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, like it was that group. And I love Led Zeppelin. So I'm not knocking performance pieces. It's just I learned at some point the difference between the two and decided that I was more interested in nice, slow, memorable, accessible hooks rather than the shred world.
Yeah. Which it's wild because some of this has happened in like everybody wants to. I'm going to get myself frustrated. Blues world, though. It's like I grew up playing blues gigs. I'm from the Mississippi Delta. It's to be expected. Mm-hmm. But when I say I grew up playing blues gigs, people get me wrong. They don't understand what I'm saying. I didn't grow up playing Robert Johnson acoustic, you know, 12 bar blues. I grew up having to play loud, having to play fast, having to learn to play behind your head. You better know how to play with your teeth. You better know all the stupid bar tricks that get people dancing and get people moving, get people interested in it's all performance.
Yeah.
To use your variations, it's all performance pieces. And so then as I've evolved and grown as a player, once you've gone down that road for so long, it gets hard to dial it back. It gets hard because I played a 4-hour gig on Friday night, this past Friday. Oh, yeah. I'm so tired. I'm so tired of 4-hour gigs. I'm so tired of them.
Oh, man.
My voice was shot by the end. You know, I'm going for notes. It was my first 4-hour gig since September of 2019.
Yeah.
So voice was shot by the end. I can't hit notes anymore at this point. And so solos are going long. but I found that, like, there were moments where I'm trying to dial it back and like be tasteful and tell the story in these songs, even though it's a blues cover gig. Let's not glorify it any more than it is.
Sure.
It's a blues cover gig. But then like there's that performer instinct that kicks in that I'm like, oh, not as many people are dancing anymore.
Yeah.
Not as many people are doing, you know, I'm not getting this interaction from the crowd anymore. So it's like, I don't even think about it. Suddenly the bar tricks come back in. And it's like, it's so hard to turn that off because that's what you start to think the effect music should have on people is.
And that's one of them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there is a place for that. And I would argue that you had a job to do and you had multiple tools in your tool belt and you were pulling out the one that was appropriate for that. You felt like you were losing them. You knew what was going to bring them back.
Yeah.
So you did it.
And that's why I've got to work on and see, this is me putting my own personal business out here. I'm finally working on an EP, working on some original stuff and who knows what it's going to be. But like my loftiest goal, like I'm 40 years old. I turned 40 in December. I'm not going to be famous. That's okay with me. Never wanted to be. But I can create music. I can play it on the road as best I can and hold a full-time job because I don't, you know, make enough, and music just doesn't make enough, especially original music, unless you quote unquote really, really make it. If I can make enough to pay the band and like not completely lose my shirt playing original music out there, that's what I want to do. Playing cover gigs for, I don't know, 100 to 400 bucks a man, you know, four or five times a month, just it's so frustrating and just tiring to play, first of all, 4 hour shows. Fuck that. I'm so over it.
That's not true. I've done some standards gigs when I was living in New York, but we were snorting a lot of cocaine, which
I did all this completely sober. Friday night, I was completely sober. And so I had one shot of Jim Beam because they were out of Jack Daniels because the state of Mississippi can't get any more Jack Daniels. Like, they're out. Like, it distributes. I did not know that whiskey distribution was affected by the pandemic, but apparently it is. But
that and lumber, man.
As someone who has been trying to buy a road case for a 2x12 this past week and getting greeted by the prices for them.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I played a 5.5 hour gig once. It was a street gig during a music festival. We had one 20-minute break. I was playing with Marshall, actually. I played bass for that gig. It was brutal. It was completely brutal.
Yeah, that's, you know, good on you for grinding that out. But, man, the gig that I took right out of college was with Vince Welnick, who was in the Grateful Dead, as well as the Tubes. Yeah. And we would do 290s, which ended up being like four songs. we would do 290s and we would take a half hour in between. Once I got done with that and moved back into the pop world, then they came down to 45s, and 45 to 60 was pretty standard.
Doing
standards gigs and stuff like that out in New York for extra cash, it's like, it was 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever. But for the most part, nobody's paying attention to you. Like, you're just there because some rich person wants to be able to show that they hired a band.
Yeah. Music to be ignored by is what I used to call it.
And so, we were barely there.
Yeah.
I once
played a standards gig for an event, and we realized how little they were paying attention to us. We just made up all of our standards. We stopped even playing basic standards. Yep. We just started making things up.
Yep. Just as long as you're playing swing, nobody cares. No, it's not like anybody's going to know. It'd be like, nobody in that, there were no like jazz aficionados at a Wall Street party. Good on you, man. I am also 40, and I don't think I could do a 4 hour.
It's brutal. I want to get to a point where I want to do original. I want to do music with my name on it. Mm-hmm. And I want to do 45s to 90s and just be done. That's about it. So I do
the Sideman thing, and I had that feeling as well for a while, where I was like, I want to put out a record of my music and I want to do my thing. And I did, and I did for a couple, we did two records, and I ended up finding the administrative aspects of that being not worth it.
I got you.
And also the other thing that would happen is, we would go set up for a gig, and I would set up at pretty much the same spot that I would set up if I was just playing for somebody else.
Yeah.
And I got so much garbage for it. And, people are like, you need to be, like front and center. I'm like, but I don't want to be. And they're like, why are you fronting a band? I'm like, good question. But so eventually I gave it up, and I'm so much happier as a result. But just because it I don't know, drummers are just so, that band in a very short period of time went through like 9 of them.
Oh,
just like,
ouch.
It was just like I, you know, drummers are the lead guitar players from the '80s, you know, they're the ones who want to be paid the most. They're the ones who are double booked all the time. They're the ones who they're the ones who got the ego thing. Cause they know, you know, like, who else are you going to find?
I'm lucky to have a couple of drummers around here. Well, one in particular that I'm playing with now, he's great. He wants to play. He's not playing a ton right now. Cause I don't know. He sort of got a full-time job and sort of fell off the gig map. And once you sort of fall off, hard to get back in. Now, my other guy from Clarksdale, he's always on the road. He is always gone. He is impossible to book anymore. And it's because he's that good, though. He really is just that good. Been playing drums since he was 5. Was on stage with B.B. King at like 9. You know what I mean? It's like, he's that guy. He's the best kept secret in the Mississippi Delta. If somebody could convince him to go to a Nashville or a New York, it's just he'd never want for good work. Instead, he's playing for what, you know, bars in Mississippi will pay, is almost nothing.
Yeah,
but he's busy. He works a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It is just generally so much work. if you're 40, you have watched the industry change.
Yeah, big time. I was at MTSU watching it change. I was outside of Nashville going to MTSU for recording industry management for a couple of years, and that was in 2003 as it started the major shift.
And so when I first started out of college and started and moved to New York, back home in Minneapolis, there were guys who were just kind of local heroes, right? And they played local gigs and they made enough money to live.
Yeah.
And out in New York, the ad agency was, yeah, the ad work was just booming. It was booming. And, you do the thing where, like, you'd go into a studio to track on them.
Instead of them just giving you the files and telling you.
Yeah, you would go into, well, it was also, 2001, 2002, right. You would go into the studio and you would you'd clock in, when you hit the elevator and you'd drink coffee and you talk and stuff like that, all to record, 30 second bumper, but you walked out of there with, like a grand in your pocket.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't exist anymore. And the truth is that music has been so devalued that nobody besides Taylor Swift is making money.
Yeah.
Exactly. And even the folks in Nashville who are doing really big things, like really great stuff, and playing with really big names, when they're not on tour, they're broke. And you'll see them. I remember talking to a woman. I was at Summer NAMM, and I had to get to the show early, and it was 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday or something like this. And I'm walking down the street towards the convention center with this woman who is hauling her drums at 8 o'clock in the morning. And at some point I turned over to her and I was like, please tell me you're coming home from a gig. And it was an awesome gig. 8 a.m. you're coming home. And she was like, no, going to set up.
Oh my God.
And I was like, are you serious? And she's like, breakfast and brunch gigs, man. We play all the time here in Nashville.
Yep.
And I was like, yeah, I suppose you're right. I'm like, that sucks. And it was a long night. so at some point I was like, who else you play with? And, you know, she listed some names. They weren't necessarily names that I recognized because I'm not super big into like the pop country world. But I did look them up, you know, like after she was, you know, as I'm walking away, I'm like, who are these people? And, you know, like she's doing real stuff.
Yeah.
Like she was playing with real people who are playing, you know, real huge venues for a lot of people. And, you know, probably, you know, not making a ton of cash. And, you know, she probably made more cash at her brunch gig than she did playing that. Yeah. On those tours. And, you know, it's just music has it's just so devalued right now. And it's really at 40, I'm having a hard time figuring out. And that's part of the reason I gave up, too. I mean, I'll say that. I'm sorry to jump, you know, part of the reason that I gave up, you know, it's the original music thing or the original band thing. My thing is like, I just got so sick and tired of like working really hard on something and putting everything into it and then having it just, you know, like it's just gone. And that's when I really pulled back into the Sideman thing, you know, or really found more comfort in that because, you know, I mean, you know, the guys I play for, or the musicians I play for, it's like if 2,000 people show up, you know, I make the same amount of money as if two people show up, you know, and if, you know, I'm not going to feel bad if there were 2,000 people who were supposed to show up and two people showed up because it's not my gig. I just play guitar for $200, or $300, whatever. And that's, but the, you know, at that point I still get to do, I get to play original music. It's just not my music. I've only been in one tribute band and it was cool. It was fun. It didn't last as long as I had hoped. And that was, I played in a Queen tribute band.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, it was cool. And it was even better because like I was the guy, like they had a league, they had a Brian May, but they needed, you know, a rhythm guy to play the parts from the records and, you know, harmonize the guitar parts and stuff like that. So I was that guy. So I was like, I just got to like playing Queen music for, you know, a couple hours a night for a ton of money. And all I was doing was just comping whatever this other guy was doing. And it was awesome. It was so great. We played at this dinner theater and we did a 2-month run there. And then the contract is up. And I mean, I made a ton of cash and, you know, then I was like, so what next? They're like, that was it. We just did it for that thing. I was like, oh
man. See, so that's a thing that's not down here in the South. And I've been talking to, for example, I've just started playing guitar for, this, well, I say just started, we've done one gig and now she's in Costa Rica studying turtles that, anyway, long story.
Got to do it.
Yeah.
Turtles need love too.
Exactly. So, but she's coming back. We're starting to do some things. It's mostly blues cover gigs, but, the woman can sing and mm-hmm. it's a fun gig cause it's making some fun music. But she's from Rhode Island originally and she's from Northeast. And so she used to sing in a Led Zeppelin Heart tribute band.
Like, cool.
That's what they, and like she and I got to talking and like that tribute band thing is not a thing down here. Cover bands are a thing, but tribute bands just aren't. You don't see those. Yeah. And so, but one of the most fun I ever had was it's pure cover band, but we had a female lead singer and we did like our own take. I'm not going to say we took a lot of liberties, but you know, we didn't try to learn note for note renditions of these cover mm-hmm. tunes. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we got the vibe, we got the idea. Then we sort of like bar band them up. You know what I mm-hmm. mean? You mm-hmm. you make them work for a bar band. And I mean, I never thought I would have as much fun as I did in that band playing Britney Spears Toxic to a, you know, a bar full of 250 drunk people.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a ton of fun doing that kind of thing. And that band was some of the best money I've made. We were playing weekends where we were pulling, you know, $400, $500, $600 a gig.
It's good
money. And that's, The worst part is this plays right into what you're saying, the devaluation of music, because the creator, the person pouring themselves into writing songs, creating something brand new, isn't going to pull that money.
Especially if it's Britney Spears, because she doesn't have control over her own money.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's that's a whole other music industry conversation that's a mess. But it's like, if it wasn't on the radio and now there's not even radio, you know,
listen to it.
No.
I listen to Spotify.
The only time the radio comes on is when I start my car and it hasn't synced to my phone yet because the radio is just on, you know?
Yeah. You know, and so I fought Spotify for a long time and I just didn't get it. I didn't get why anyone would be interested in it.
Yeah.
And I realized a number of years ago, but I realized that I was using, this is before smart TVs. And so if you wanted to watch Netflix, you would use it through your Blu-ray player. And I had a Blu-ray player. I had never owned or rented a single Blu-ray. And this, this entire thing's purpose was to get me to Netflix. And once I was able to draw that comparison, like, I own this thing that takes me to a streaming service and that's all I want, you know, then I realized why streaming music is what it is now. And I eventually, just for my own enjoyment, I eventually, succumbed to it. But I still think it ruined music. I partake in it, but that's, you know, it's kind of one of those, if you can't beat them, join them. But I remember I was in France on my honeymoon, and Spotify existed in Europe, but it wasn't in the US yet.
Okay.
And I remember, sitting in, our hotel room and downloading Spotify and just experiencing it for the first time. And I didn't know at the time that, like, what I was experiencing was what was eventually going to kill all of my dreams.
It's weird. Like, Spotify, I have this very, very mixed opinion about streaming in general. We'll use Spotify as the figurehead, but it could have been Pandora before Spotify. You know what
sure,
I mean?
Sure.
It could be Tidal now, as Tidal's mm-hmm. growing, or whatever you want to talk about. Yes. And this is funny. I talked about this on a past podcast. So listeners, I apologize that I'm telling you a story you've already heard. But when I was at MTSU, '02 and '03, and that was right when, like, Recording Industry Association of America was starting to sue, like, 13-year-olds because they downloaded whatever the latest Spice Girls. Spice Girls may not even been a thing then. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
And I had this conversation.
Lars Ulrich, just so
yes. I was having conversations with professors, and this is right about the time that EMI closed, like, shut down. And so I told him, because we talked about these things in, like, copyright law and music industry history and those kinds of, history of the music industry, whatever they called it. And I said, the national star is dying. It's going to be dead. Like, it's going to be gone. You're going to have a few lingering, like, big time national stars, but you're going to have a lot fewer. And what's going to happen, you're going to see a return to the model from pre-Elvis. And pre-Elvis, there wasn't a national star like we saw with Elvis. There were big stars, but they're usually regional, mm-hmm. or they had an appeal within a certain market and certain demographic. It's like with blues artists, I tell people all the time, it wasn't until Elvis that the performer became more important than the song. Because you saw pre-Elvis, a hit song would hit the radio. The 45 would come out of, whatever tune came out. Before you know it, 15 other artists have recorded their version of that song to get it out there to try to sell records because the song was more important than the person that sang it. And then Elvis came along and he became the persona. And suddenly this rise. Now, you had Sinatra just before Elvis, and you started to see it happening there. But it really happened with Elvis. And so I said, we're going to go back to a time period where it's not as much about this big national star. And I think we're starting to see it. And so where I was going with this whole incredibly long diatribe was that my mixed opinion on Spotify is that while, yes, it has wrecked, it has been a complete and utter game changer in the music industry, I think for creators, it gave them some power, though, to be artists who would have never had the opportunity to have other people hear their music.
Yeah, you can. I mean, this is kind of a classic glass half full, glass half empty thing. You know, absolutely. On one hand, the playing field has been leveled
big time,
and that is cool, and I appreciate that. But what we need to have happen on the other side of it is we need to figure out how to compensate. Like you can level the playing field and still have it be valuable.
Absolutely.
You know, and what ended up happening was just, you know, the playing field was leveled and music was devalued. And, you know, I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know that particular factoid about Elvis.
Well, so that's not, I won't call it a factoid. That's my observations from the histories that, but it, to me, it felt like that was the point where you really had like a star, like a national star.
Yeah.
Who wasn't a movie star, at least not at that point.
Right. Not until he started doing movies. Yeah,
exactly. You know, you had movie stars like Marilyn Monroe and John Wayne. You had these big national figures in movies, and some of them happened to be singers.
Yeah.
But you didn't really have like the big national music star until Elvis.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of them were Robin from Little Richard.
Oh, completely. Absolutely were. It's an interesting thing. But you're right. We've got to figure out compensation. And if you go into the law of it, again, another story I've mentioned before, but it's interesting to talk it out with someone else, is that the part of the damage that was done for artists as streaming became a thing. And I really need to look this up so I can talk more specifically about it, and because I'm a librarian and I like to cite my sources. Mm-hmm. But so record contracts are, and you know this, listener, if you don't know this, record contracts are complicated. They're long, arduous documents that it isn't, oh, you're going to get X percent of this. No, it breaks it down so granularly that, okay, you're going to get X percent of radio mechanical royalties. You're going to get X percent of any sync licensing that we get for you. You're going to get X percent of this, X percent of that. Every different category has its own percentage. Well, streaming fell into a category in traditional record contracts that had almost no value to the artist before streaming existed. And so a lot of record contracts gave as much as 100% of the income from that category to the record label because the artist already knew there was going to be no money in it. Well, suddenly there was a ton of money in it, and artists saw no revenue. Instead, Spotify got their cut first, like a bad manager, and then all the record labels made all the money off of streaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's of the little bit of money that was going their way anyway, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know the answer. I just see the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the answer is you do what someone like Taylor Swift has done, and you just sell a lot of merch.
Yeah.
And you own the merch. And that's I have to believe that's how Taylor Swift makes a lot of her money.
I have heard the amount of money she makes on merch in an individual night, like any given concert night. And it is in the very high six figures on even a slow night.
Yeah. And that's hers, you know, the record company doesn't own her t-shirts. So yeah, you know, there's all different kinds of, who was it? It wasn't Bowie. It was another one of those, you know, kind of legendary rock musicians. And you kind of at the beginning of this world we live in now. And like, it may have been Roger Daltrey. I don't know. But he said something to the effect of, you know, you used to tour to support a record.
Right.
And now you put out a record to support a tour. And you tour to sell merch.
That's it. That's how you make the money.
It's like, God, that's terrible.
Oh, but it's a horrible model. And you know, we talk about Bonamassa, and I have a love hate with Bonamassa. I think the man works his ass off. Genuinely think he works his ass off. I think some artists at some point are gonna have to start using his model.
Well, and so correct me if I'm wrong here. His model is that he rents the venue, and he staffs the venue, and he sells the tickets, and like everything, like all of that stuff anything that could be can be under his control is under his control.
That's
that correct?
Right. That is exactly right.
Yeah. Ben Queller used to do that too. I don't know if you remember Ben Queller.
I don't off the top of my head, but I'm also terrible with names. So,
Well, he's not necessarily a big memorable one, but I remember talking to him at South by Southwest one year, and he was doing that same thing, and Joe's doing it better, and yeah, man, you know, like, good for him on that, because he has taken control of his own destiny, and you know, he's made enough money doing it to buy every freaking burst on the planet. Yeah. You know, so.
Yeah, no, he's. I was down in New Orleans at International Guitar. What's the name? Anyway, it's International Guitar something. It's one of my favorite music stores. But that the Cajun that he plays. If you've ever seen any of his rundowns of his gear, he's got one burst he calls the Cajun, and it was in that shop, and he had bought it like a week before I came in the shop, and so I was like, I would have at least liked to have seen it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, well, we're at a point now where we've gone just over an hour. We're going to wrap things up. Listeners, we sure appreciate y'all hanging out. Remember that there is going to be extra content over on our Patreon exclusive feed. Ryan and I are actually going to talk about gear. I realized we made it through this entire episode. We didn't talk about gear
not once.
We're going to talk about some gear over on the Patreon episode. So if you want to, you can join us there. Patreon.com/40Watt Podcast. I appreciate y'all listening. I appreciate y'all hanging out. Please rate, review, thumbs up, subscribe, leave a comment, all of those things that you hear everyone tell you to do on all of these platforms. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, be good to yourselves, be kind to each other, and try to make some noise. This episode is brought to you by the supporters of 40 Watt Podcast over on Patreon. Go over to patreon.com/40Watt Podcast, where for as little as $3 per month, you can help support the podcast and get every episode ad-free. For $5 a month, you'll get every episode ad-free, as well as a bonus episode every week. I can't overstate how thankful I am for the support of my patrons, and hope you'll consider joining the team and helping keep this show on the road.